white is black, or better yet, all is gray like a cadaver. When the life has bled away, let us go to the market where greed ensnares with rate stairs, stock shares, weights and tears. The roads lead on to anywhere, fortune, boom, bust, dust, doom, despair. We're at the song of the bell, the hollow man yells to buy, but holds and sell. No right and wrong, only means and ends, as long as the ends are dividends. Follow the megaphones drone to the edge of a park where the revolution howls like a wolf in the dark. Can't sleep from the deep, move swift like a shark, climbing up the scent to the belly exposed. Then flash the slash and then the jaws are closed, and then the victim dashes in his final throes as the seating's red as a rose. Kingdom come, drawn by the smell of the blood and chum. Kingdom come, drunk on the drama of a martyrdom. Others for the feed the frenzy of the new regime, because the revolution always eats its own. It can't fold on the king, cannot uproot the throne. Still over the bend, well, with bright wings, moves his spirit that will lift, fill it all things. Move stars and atoms, with his span between the world of sense and the past unseen. Still over the bend, well, his spirit sing across the waste and let the hosannas ring. Out in the darkness one crashes to remake all things new. To remake all things new. Tick tock goes the clock. Tick tock goes the clock. Tick tock goes the clock. Tick tock. Tick tock goes the clock until the toll and the bell breaks the spell. Cracks open the world like a shell. Summons the dead that stand where they fell between the bliss of heaven and the abyss of hell. This is the junction between joy and compunction, where the laws of effect and cause start to function. It's the real, no higher court of appeal. The time to make plain what I laid concealed. All revealed, too late to recant, to repeal, to repent. We have the time and all the time is spent. So ever descending, the all transcending, never ending, whose reaches over all extending. Come to men, come to rent, come to blame, to reclaim, come to cast all down and raise it up again. This spirit full of love from above is falling like a dove, like a flame, like a bomb, exploding gentler than a breeze, more thunderous than a storm. What power will tremble when the kingdom comes? Still over the hands, you better lift them up high over the waters of the flood to keep them all safe and dry over the rivers of God.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
If I could save time in a bottle, the first thing that I'd like to do is to save every day till eternity passes away, just to spend them with you. If I could make days last forever, if words could make wishes come true, I'd save every day like a treasure, and then again I would spend them with you. But there never seems to be enough time to do the things you want to do once you find them. I've looked around enough to know you're the one I want to go through time with. If I had a box just for wishes and dreams that had never come true. The box would be empty except for the memory of how they were answered by you. But there never seems to be enough time to do the things you want to do once you find them. I've looked around enough to know you're the one I want to go through time.
Well, I'm back. It's Time in a Bottle by Jim Croce. You know, one of the things in the height of society, in almost all your Aboriginal societies, is humor. But the humor never has any barbs in it. To give an example of, we'll say, a height of insult, a friend of mine and I were talking one day, and I said to him, I said, "Geez, I'm stupid." He smiled and said, "I know." And then when I was a teenager, we were crewing on my father's purse seiner for fishing salmon, and a piece of cable scratched my face, and I was standing looking in the mirror putting some medicine on it. It was called Mercurochrome. It's no longer on the market. But anyway, this one relative, an older guy, I was 15, he was about 20. He said, "What are you doing, sonny?" I said, "I'm putting medicine on my face." He said, "There's no medicine for ugly."
Well.
Except whiskey.
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, your girlfriend said that doesn't work for you." So we tease each other a lot. One day he's eating soup and he said, "Damn, I missed my mouth." The other guy, "How could you miss something that big?"
Mm-hmm.
So there's no barbs in it. And it's always teasing. In fact, our word for cousin, I guess you'd say, is tawi. Tawi really means that we're so closely related, we can joke with each other real hard and we can't get mad. So no matter what we do in life, we always find something that we can laugh about. And even when I was growing up, the old men would take some of us they were training and put us in situations where we had to figure out how to get out of it. excuse me. And they would tell us stories about things that they'd seen people do and how it was done. There was an old man at home, I forget his Haida name, but his English name was George Vandal. Anyway, the people in my village were given the opportunity, the option to either become a reservation, which is in the United States. I was born in Alaska. So this was in Heidelberg, Alaska. And so the people had a choice as to whether to become a reservation or not. And so there was quite a bit of controversy about it, and the town was split about 50-50, and they called a public meeting. And it was just about the fist fights when George Vandal walked in. And the U.S. government lawyer is called a solicitor. Here in Canada, that's more of a general term, but that's specifically a government lawyer. Well, he walked in, and the lawyer's name was Mr. Curry. So George walked up to the front of the room, and there was no microphone, so you had to learn to throw your voice. Mm. And it's like, "Law agent, you know, hey, it's me." It's the way he said it. Mm-hmm. And when he got their attention, he said, "You folks, I think we should listen to what Mr. Curry has to say. After all, he's our liar."
A liar.
And so the whole room cracked up and all the tension went out of the room. But they would do things like that. One of my classmates from law school was a tribal judge in Pine Ridge, South Dakota. He was Lakota.
Right.
And he was telling me about there's Pine Ridge Reservation and then there's Rosebud, and they were always at odds with each other. And they had a public meeting to deal with some kind of an issue that affected both reservations. And Pastors was chairing this meeting. And about a half hour into the meeting, things were getting pretty heated, people yelling at each other and whatever. And this old man walked in, and there was an aisle down the center, and he walked down the center, and there's a microphone there. So he stood there, and he didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. So Fast Horse asked, "Is there something you wish to say?"
Right.
And he said, "Yes." He said, "I left home early. I want to apologize for being late, but I left home early enough to get here on time. And as I was driving here, I didn't know exactly where everything was.
Right.
Then I saw all those cars, so I pulled in the park." And he said, "I drove around there about 30 minutes before I realized I was in a junkyard."
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, everybody started laughing.
Yeah.
Oh, see.
Oh, sorry.
And you know, so everybody started laughing, and again, it took the tension out of the room. And so this is a device that's used throughout the indigenous world. No matter where you go, there's always people that know how to do these things, and so that's what we're being taught to do. And so when we see a situation that's kind of tense, we watch to see for the right moment how to take the tension out of the room. Well, something that's been really bothering me a great deal, and I don't really know how to deal with it. Back in the 1970s, I worked as a construction worker on the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. And that's a 48-inch pipe, which is considerably bigger than most.
Right.
And I was a member of the Operating Engineers Union, and at first I was working as a service oiler and then later as a field mechanic. And now my son-in-law works on maintenance of that oil pipeline. And the way that pipeline was built, they went to a great deal of trouble to make sure that they didn't thaw the permafrost, where they would take bulldozer and they'd cut the surface overburden off, and they put in layers of styrofoam and then this black plastic we call visqueen, and then they built a haul road on top of that. And the haul road was fairly wide, a little more than two lanes wide. Some places the pipe was buried, but where it wasn't buried, it was covered with, the supports holding it up were actually refrigeration units. They were sunk down into the ground to keep the permafrost frozen. And then the pipe itself was covered with insulation because it was coming out of the ground up at Prudhoe Bay up on the Arctic Ocean and then was transported, I don't know, couple thousand miles or so, however far it was, from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez, where it was loaded on a ship.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they had heaters inside those 1 million gallon tanks. In fact, I was inside one of them. I worked there at Pump Station 1 during the construction, and I saw the radiators and the propellers inside there to keep the oil moving and warm. And then they pump it south. Well, it was insulated so that the heat didn't get out, but at the same time, it protected the pipe, and it had fire retardant. And from what I understand later, they put in a sprinkler system so that if there was a fire, they could activate the sprinklers. And what was really bothering me about this pipeline that's anticipated or planned to come from Alberta to we'll say, to Vancouver or wherever it is on the coast, what are we going to do if one of these wildfires goes through that area? And one of my concerns was, how do you get to it? Well, we just had another oil spill, this one in Alberta. And to leak as 150,000 liters or something like that of oil, it had to leak for a long time and nobody detected. But then when they went to work on it, they couldn't get to it because there was no haul road. And so what if it had been a fire, you know, these wildfires have come through there?
Mm.
And even if you could turn it off, you know, the oil in the pipeline would heat up and then the vapors explode. So what are you going to do to protect against that? So that's bothering me. And then this whole thing with Premier Christie, she is selling liquid natural gas. If you watch she stands up on a podium with a sign behind her saying, right in fact, in front of her, liquid
LNG.
LNG, yeah. And so where do we fit into it? Where does the environment fit into it? When you hear about all these wildfires, does anybody ask what happened to all the birds in there? What happened to the small animals? What happened to insects? What happened to larger animals? What happens to the fish in the water that gets too hot that it kills them? So what is going on? But we don't care. When I was working on my degree in economics, this is back in 1971, I graduated in 72, but when we were putting together these economic models, I asked, well, where's the environment in this? And I was told the environment is an externality. It has no effect on anything.
Right.
And so here we are, 2015. What's that? 40 years or so later, and it's still an externality.
Right.
They don't really even give it any consideration. Right now, we want another, we're talking about 1 million more people coming to Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And we're already at the point where we're controlling the use of water. Where are we going to get more? People are fracking and using all sorts of industrial uses for the water that we drink. So where's it going to come from? Mm-hmm. And they think they can solve the problem by having TransLink. That's not going to solve it. You're still going to have too darn many people. And if you build a subway up here to UBC, yeah, it has to go underground. What's it going to do? It's going to cut through some natural streams that have been paved over, and they got rid of salmon. And there's other people trying to expose them back to the air so that we can have some salmon again,
mm-hmm,
because the land depends on the salmon for the nitrogen, and everything comes from their bodies. So we're setting ourselves up for extinction. And I was trained from early childhood to be an oral historian. An oral historian was not taught like everybody else.
Right.
Everybody else just sort of listened to stories, but with us it was very, very intense teaching. It was like hypnosis sessions. I would walk in, old man, and it was all done in Haida, even when it was against the law. If they got caught, they would all gone to jail.
Right.
So I'd walk in, Outlaguna, sit down, dear boy. Aji dunch kindang song. I'm going to show you something. Dunkleeki, prepare yourself. And so this is where I had to close my eyes. I put my head down so that my chin was on my chest, and lace my fingers together and put them across on my solar plexus so I could feel my heartbeat and I could feel my breathing. And I would slow them down,
right,
and clean my mind, take out all the stuff that's there. And then when I was prepared, I'd say to Hilke, I'm prepared, my mind is ready.
Mm-hmm.
And this person would start talking. And the way these things were told is you don't memorize the words, you see images. It's like you go inside that person, you experience everything they're telling you. So when you go to tell it to somebody else, you're telling it as having experienced it personally. So I was taught history going back. Well, I've identified something that happened 78,000 years ago. In our calendar, that's 15 cycles. There's about 5,200 years to each cycle. The last ice age was 5 cycles, 26,000 years ago when it started.
Right.
And now we're back to the first cycle, so we're moving into an ice age again. But these things follow these certain patterns. And so we're told all the things that are going to happen. It's get warmer, to get colder. It's going to get warmer, then colder, then warmer, then colder. And then, boop, we hit a tipping point.
It's similar to El Nino, La Nina. El Nino, La Nina type,
mm-hmm,
type thing.
Except
from the oceans.
Like right now, this is the warmest year on record, period.
Right.
And at the same time in Australia, they're getting below zero temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're getting ours here. And so It's sort of like when you have a ball attached to a rubber band. You swing it, and each turn it goes a little bit. When you pull it back,
right,
it comes back faster and goes farther past. So you can't reach an equilibrium with this thing here because we keep messing with it. I forget how many countries are involved in it, but the cloud seeding has been going on for years now.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're trying. In fact, the U.S. one time changed the track of a hurricane, but they changed it in the wrong direction, and it caused a whole lot of damage in one of the states, and they had to go and pay for it,
mm,
because they had said this is what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. And so Canada's been involved in it too. So you keep moving the rain someplace else and it keeps getting farther and farther out of whack. Mm. So anyway, I guess we're going to have to take a break here for a month.
Yes, that's right. So we're going to take a break. This is Language to Language. You're speaking with Woody, with all of his native stories. It's very fascinating to hear to hear your stories. I'm DJ Ray. Of course, you've probably heard of me from the late night show from Saturdays at 12:30 later on. So yeah, so we're going to take a break and we'll come right back in just a moment.
Don't miss the All Nations Festival from July 23rd to 25th in Coquitlam. It's an annual festival of music, art, food, sports, and ideas celebrating Coast Salish territory. The three-day celebration includes two free live music stages featuring the Funk Hunters, DJ Headspin, Oz12, and more. Dozens more events listed online at www.allnationsfest.com.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
This is Language to Language on CITR 101.9 FM, on streaming online at CITR.ca. I'm DJ Ray, along with
Woody.
I have to look at the board to see who's who. So, interesting. Tell us more about the environment on...
Well, I'll stall back up a little bit.
Yeah, just when we
one of the things that I should have done at the beginning is to introduce myself the way we do in Haida. In Haida, I have three names. Kit'ukun, that's the man who killed a giant brown bear. That's the one who faces adversity. Kodahangas was the name that was given to me as a child, and this is a person who knows when to let go, to fly high above and observe. And then when I graduated from law school, I was given the name Kawan Sangha. Kawan means walking, Sangha is day. But this describes a man walking in a room carrying a newborn child. I was the first Haida to bring home a Juris Doctor degree. So my uncle said, that's your name, you carried the first one in. So that's what my name is. Chatlanas Hatai Udi Ijin. Katsakas Diukalakn. I'm of the Chatlanas clan of the Haida Nation. Chatlanas are our crests equal with two heads. Katsakas Diukalakn. Our population, or Kuala, is divided into two parts, eagle and raven, and I'm from the eagle part of it. And my father, he's on the other side because we follow our mother. My father was Huye, or we use the word Yat in Alaska. We borrow that from the Tlingit people. Mm. In English, Dr. Woodrow Morrison, B.A., J.D., Hinudiya Achatai Kilkyang. So in English, I'm called Dr. Woodrow Morrison. I have a B.A. and a J.D. But the out Chayang Hino Hatkit Virginia Cloud Hino maiden name Laga Hidan. My mother's name was Chayang in Haida, but it was a Tlingit name, means the firstborn. Her maiden name was Virginia Cloud. Wagan di Hung Hansanan Wood Amors and Kyagan Iskandla Dai Hatkit Kyagan. And my father his name in English was Woodrow Morrison. In Haida, he was called Tladai. He was chief of the Brown Bear House. Dinan Uviola Nakatla Nung Hengundals Iskan Stlai Twawai Kuyawas Hinu Dinan Kaang Hidam. So my grandmother, my father's mother, in English was Viola Nakatla Morrison. She had two Haida names. Stlai Tuai Kuiwas is the woman with the healing hands. And then the other name, Nung Hengundals, that's a deep sea rolling wave. This is the power of the ocean. So anyway, our names are not just labels. They tell who we are. The name when I was a little boy, Kaut Hangas. Kautla means to sit down, and Hangas is something unpleasant to look at. So the English equivalent would be ugly sit down, but it describes an eagle that got a hold of a salmon that was too large. It got pulled underwater, and normally under those circumstances the eagle will drown, because when its legs are stiff, straight out, it can't open its talons. So this one pulled itself deeper in the water and was able to let go and get to the surface and manage to get ashore, and then flew up and is sitting on top of a tree drying its feathers in the sun. And when it's doing that, its feathers are sticking out in all directions. It's very ugly to look at. But that name says that I'm related to the salmon people, who are very powerful, mysterious people that make great, great journeys. And so this is a way of coming to knowledge. And also it says I sit on the tree, which tells that I'm Chatlana, because the eagle sits on the tree. And it says it sits on top of the tree, which tells what my status or my position would be as Ye'e, which is sort of high class, I guess you say. But in our word, it really means is becoming pure. Because, see, a leader, the leader was chosen, the person chosen to be trained to be a leader was usually the least perfect. Because you take somebody that's the most perfect, you can't really teach them much. Mm-hmm. But the least perfect is sort of like you take raw ore, say a piece of copper, you throw it in a fire, and as it heats, the copper begins to swell up and the impurities begin to fall off. You take it out of the fire and you hammer on it, knock some more off, put it back in the fire, and you do this repeatedly until finally you have a pure copper. And so this is the way the training of these young imperfect ones were. We were put in a fire. We had to figure out our way out. And then the teachings, we were run through, we'll say, ordeals, this sort of thing, in a training to become that kind of person. So the whole process is becoming pure, is how it's described. Mm. But when we talk about the environment, that copper is not a resource. That's my relative. That's my grandfather, those stones. The plants are all my grandmother's, so we don't talk about that as resources. That's my relatives.
Right.
And all those other things are my sisters, my brothers, my uncles.
Your nephews.
And so we have to treat those things with that same respect. See, in one of our early stories, it tells about when people started accumulating things. This haga, this medicine person, warned them, when you start accumulating things, you have to be careful, because if you're not, the worm could get in your mind. It will create a need for stuff you don't need. To protect against that, you always have to give something back, because if the worm gets in your mind, you become tskuju. You start grabbing and you can't stop. And so that's what all wars are fought over, people grabbing and grabbing and grabbing. Not even, they don't even want it or need it. They just got to keep grabbing. This is the way of millionaires, billionaires, and many others. So to give something back, that doesn't mean when I take something, I merely replace it. What it was say our family, our clan, our tribe, people are very hungry. We go looking for food. We don't go hunting for deer. When we say that, we say the deer has no say in this relationship. So we go take a look around to see what's out there. And when it presents itself, we either accept the gift or we give it back.
Right.
In our case, we never take the first one. We always give that one back. This ensures that people coming after us will always have something. So that is why the potlatch was outlawed by the Europeans, is because it is absolutely, totally contrary to capitalism. Because in our system, we always have to give back. In this capitalistic society, the value or price of something is dependent upon how scarce it is.
Right.
So the more scarce, the higher the price. So you can't give anything back. You got to keep taking. You become Scrooge. You got to keep grabbing.
Mm-hmm.
And also in a capitalistic society, you're told don't trust. You do, and somebody will take advantage of you. Don't share, because you give up what you got, they're going to end up with more than you do. And you don't cooperate. You compete. You always got to compete and look out for number one. And the fourth rule is you can never have too much. You can never have too much. It's not you can't get enough. You can never have too much. Whereas right. in a tribal society, many of you may not have heard of the residential school system, and some of you have. The beginning of the residential school system began with a statement that we have to destroy the tribal system and assimilate everyone. And to destroy the tribal system is really what they were doing, and that's why they took 150,000 children and did horrible things to them, and it's still going on.
Mm.
But the tribal system requires that we trust each other, mm-hmm. that we share with each other, we cooperate with one another, and we give back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's totally the antithesis of this Western society. And so when we take a look at where are we now, when the Europeans came here, there were millions of salmon. In Falls Creek, there were thousands that went up the streams there.
Yes.
Now there's nothing there.
No.
Everywhere you look, there's nothing, because everything has a dollar value attached to it. And so when we look at the environment, it's what's happening with those wildfires here in B.C., and also in Alberta, Saskatchewan, whatever, they're looking at it in terms of how much money are we losing, how much does it cost.
Right.
There's a guy here in Vancouver calls himself, or whoever calls him that, Mr. Fireworks. And I saw an article about him on a paper last week
yes.
where he was complaining that he couldn't do his fireworks shows because it was, somebody said it's too dry.
Right.
And I'm losing all this money. That's all he worried about. He said, maybe I'll do a rain dance on my house. Well, it tells me he doesn't know a darn thing about Native people out here.
Oh.
And he was just mocking. If he does, he was mocking us, because a rain dance is something that might have been done out in the prairies, but never here on the coast.
No.
And we're not rainmakers. But here we have cloud seeding people. So the only thing he's concerned about is losing money. Where we're looking at, we can lose a whole lot of other things. You know, as the temperature gets too high, the salmon can't go up the stream, and if they do, they spawn, and the eggs will die because the water's too warm.
Right.
So what happens to the invertebrates down at the mouth of the river that eat these things, you know, when they die? And there's a whole chain of events there. But that's not of no concern, because we've got to worry about the bottom line, and also for myself. I was worked for a Native corporation in Alaska. I was president of the timber company and also the fisheries.
Right.
And we had logging operations going on. Then I went to take a look at it, and I told them, look, either you start doing certain things or stop other things, or I'm going to shut you down.
Mm-hmm.
When you get to a certain slope on a hill, you have to do soil stability tests to make sure that when you cut the trees, the soil isn't going to slide away.
Right.
And when you're cutting near a salmon stream, you had to stay at least 300 meters away from the bank of the stream. If you came to an eagle nest tree, you had to have an area of, I think it was 300 feet in circumference around that. You couldn't cut any nearer than that. Well, they were violating these things, so I went and said, look, either you stop and start following the rules, or I'm going to shut you down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this Native Board of Directors called me in and told me that only the bottom line was important.
Mm-hmm.
So I quit my job and I went to work for Environmental Protection. So that's what I used my legal training for, was to do that. So here we are now faced with, what do we do? Well, I'll put it this way. A little over a week ago, I was riding on my bike up near, I guess it's about 10th and McDonald, somewhere on there.
Okay.
And I saw a sign that says church for sale.
Mm.
And the first question came to me was a smart-ass remark of, who got evicted, God or the preacher. And anyway, so I have some issues with Christianity, but it's not up to me to really criticize or anything, but that's not mine.
Right.
But anyway, the next day I went back to look at, take the time to look at the church, because I've been by it many times.
Yes.
Beautiful little church. And had a bell tower on, I guess you might say, and a spire up there. But when I read the sign, I asked, why are they selling this church? What happened to the congregation? Where are they? Mm-hmm. There were weddings here, there were funerals here, the baptisms here. People came here for, you know, to seek shelter and happiness. Now it's gone.
I just want to ask a question. Is this church kind of like east of where McDonald and 10th, or is it west of?
It's right on 10th.
Okay.
So it's 11th. No, I mean, it's not McDonald, but probably just a block away, up from McDonald, not quite to Stevens.
Okay.
And anyway, so I was wondering, now, why would they sell a church? How do you sell a church? Then I saw it. Mm-hmm. One line with three words, prime kits location. Mm. So that thing's going to go for a few million dollars. But then what happened to the congregation? So then, you know, where does God go when you sell the church?
Yeah.
And so when I was thinking about these things, I thought to myself, in our way, God is everywhere. Mm-hmm. So if we sell out to the pipelines, if we sell out to the LNG and to those things, are we selling our church? What price is my soul? What price is my spirit? And so I have to ask those questions rather than how much money am I going to get? What am I selling? Am I selling the future of my grandchildren? Am I selling what few vestiges we have of our own humanity to where we start worrying about number one? Mm-hmm. And about grabbing and not letting go. So all these kinds of questions came to my mind. And even when we talked about the Residential School Commission report, I thought to myself, well, we can go back and revisit everything, the horrible atrocities, or we can even ask what kind of a system created those monsters. But if I ask that question, then I have to ask myself, do those seeds exist in me? To be one of those, because I was a very violent person when I got home from residential school and from the military, and it took me a while to deal with. So then the next question became one of, instead of berating them for being monsters, how do we heal ourselves? And those of us who seem to be doing fairly well, how do we help the others? Because if I'm not strong enough to stand up myself, how can I pick somebody else up? So in Haida, it's called Gudengai Tlatska. That means I have to keep my mind strong. It means I never let fear get in front of me. So these are the ways, and I have to have a soft mind.
Right.
Because in this society, we're taught to hate and fear women.
Excuse me.
To hate and fear women, and also to make them really worthless. And that's really what the church has done, that's what Islam has done. And even, what's his name, the Buddha.
The Lord
that
Buddha?
You had to even dump your family so that you could seek this nirvana.
Right.
So it's all about us, but yet I think it's really strange. In Haida, to be a kind person, you have to have a soft mind.
Right.
And some of the biggest, rowdiest guys I've ever seen sometimes are the most gentle. They're the ones who are the kindest because they don't have to prove how tough they are by making somebody else look weak or small. So anyway, in looking at that world, I can't change the world.
No.
Even if I had a cape.
Right. A real superhero.
So what I do is I'm in a process of now of putting back to a class that I've been teaching for the last 5 years on cultural values, the traditional, we'll say tribal cultural values.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all centered primarily around Haida.
Okay.
But I've traveled around maybe half of the world, listening to storytellers wherever I could find them and listening to the values that they're articulating. And so that's what I do is when I'm teaching a class, if you came into my class and you spoke a language other than English or some other language, whatever. Right. We want to hear that language. We want to hear what it sounds like. We want to hear what your story of creation is. This way, when we hear other voices and other languages, we have less conflict. Because, see, in Haida, when I say or a woman says, "Di hat agen," I'm saying I'm human. Mm-hmm. So we're all human. Race is a competition to be number one. So we don't use that. We refer to person, what's your nationality, rather than what's your race.
Want to go for a final break?
Yep.
All right. This has been, you're listening to Language to Language with Woody. I'm Kelly at the controls, and we will be right back.
Machine Gun Kelly.
Thanks.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
In every Thursday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, where we bring you the Community Living Show. A full hour is produced by the disabled community, showcasing for BC self-advocates, with lots of interesting and fun content, including some interviews from special guests with special needs. Join hosts Michael, Kelly, and friends every Thursday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM and streaming online at citr.ca. Because you've got a friend in community living and CITR.
And I got them too. Yeah, isn't it? Yes, of course, and that's what we have on our show, Community Living Show, people with special needs and people with disabled people and special needs. That's what I do on the show. And we were just talking during the break about residential schools and then with the First Nations people and, of course, the...
The ones in the States are different.
And then the correctional ones, like the people with disabilities and stuff, what I do mm-hmm. for my show. So, and maybe explain a little bit more about the residential homes.
Your side. In the U.S., when the U.S. government was first getting involved, it was under the War Department. The Indians came under the War Department. So a school was opened in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and so all the boys, men, all wore uniforms, and so it was sort of like a military academy. Right. And then gradually they started building more and more schools. There was another one in Lawrence, Kansas called Haskell Institute, and that's one I went to.
Right.
And there was another one in Riverside, California called Sherman Institute, and that's where my father and my mother went to school.
Okay.
In Oklahoma was one called Shalako. In Oregon was Chemawa Indian School. In Alaska was Wrangell Institute, and then later Mount Edgecombe, where I graduated high school, was Mount Edgecombe School. But there was also a church-run school called Sheldon Jackson School, named after the Alaska's first commissioner of education, a Presbyterian minister named Sheldon Jackson. And so that's where I went for 2 years, and we had to learn... We had to study the Bible, New Testament, Old Testament, right. Go to church, all this other stuff.
All the religious stuff.
But we didn't have the horrendous stuff that was going on in these schools because we were a little bit older. If you came from a village where there was a day school, you didn't leave until you finished grade 8.
Right.
So by the time you got to school, you're big enough to fight back. And so with us Haidas, we would fight back against anybody anyway.
Right.
In fact, we used to protect some of the smaller kids if somebody was giving them a hard time. And the only time I ever had a staff member make a pass at me is there were three of us in a room together called North Siberia. It was the third floor of a wooden frame building. Mm-hmm. In wintertime, the heat didn't get up there. It was steam, so it was pretty damn cold in winter, so that's why it was called North Siberia. But we had a dormitory attendant that would come at night, you know, and he'd shake hands and start running his hands on. And I pushed him away, and I said, get your hands off me. I was 14, I think, or 15 years old. And so I told my two roommates, if he puts his hand on me again, I'm going to punch him. So the next night he came into our room, and he went to the Tlingit guy. There was me and his Tlingit, Tom, and Dene guy, Harold. And when he was over by Tom, all of a sudden I heard this meaty smack. Guy hit the floor. Tom punched him.
Right.
He jumped up and he was crying and apologizing and explaining why he was shaking hands. He had a friend he had arguments with, and the friend died before he could make amends.
Right.
So that ended right there. So anyway, that was my only experience with that. But they kicked me out of there because I wouldn't play by the rules of becoming a Christian. So they sent me to the government school, and so I graduated from there. And then I went to Lawrence, Kansas, to another school, Haskell Institute. But see, the difference there was you actually learned something.
Right.
When I finished at Mount Edgecombe High School, there were 108 in my graduating class. I was number 105, and the other three didn't get diplomas. So I was the very bottom of my class.
Right.
I didn't have any study halls because I was liable to get into a fight. I was always in trouble. So to punish me, they'd send me to the library. And I loved the library. That was my favorite place in the world to go to. But when I was handed my diploma, the superintendent said to me, Woodrow, I'll be willing to bet you'll be in prison before you're 19. Mm. And that so infuriated me, I went back to the library. And I got an application I'd seen in there for the University of Washington. And anyway, my mother was there for my graduation, and three of my sisters there were four of us at the school, but I don't ever remember talking to them. Anyway, they had to fly us back to my village about 300 miles away. And I filled out that thing. I sent it away. They sent me a packet of stuff, a bunch of exams. I went to school, wrote the exams, and I got accepted. Mm. So I got accepted to the University of Washington in 1959. Mm-hmm. I was 17 years old. But like I said, they actually taught us something. And there was no scholarships. I had $1,000 from working on my father's boat as a commercial fisherman.
Right.
And I'd saved from a time, I guess I was about 9 years old when I started fishing with him. So I had $1,000 to go to university, and that was to pay for my travel there, pay for my room and board, pay for tuition, books, everything.
Right.
But I squandered it. In 6 months, I went broke.
Wow. Interesting.
So anyway, I went back home, and I worked in a program called, it was a poverty program, anti-poverty. And we worked 9 hours a day, 6 days a week, and we made $1.90 an hour, and there was no taxes taken out of it. We were building trestles and fixing roads and all kinds of things. So in the fall, I went to Haskell Institute in Kansas, and my younger sister was sent to Oklahoma. And my older sister was in Wind River, Wyoming. But anyway, so I started in welding, but I kept myself, catch myself on fire, I'd fall asleep, oxyacetylene welding, watching the puddle of metal going around.
Right.
I hypnotized myself.
Oh.
So I moved out into radio and electronics.
Yes.
And then I turned 21 in December of 1962. And I knew the U.S., the draft was going to get me to go in the Army. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to go in the Army. So I became a draft dodger. I went and volunteered for the Navy. So
nice.
I spent 4 years in the Navy. Then when I got out, I went back to school. And I think my veterans benefits paid something like $115 a month or something like that, practically zero. But anyway, I stuck with it, and I finally graduated. But when I was in a school, in electronics school, Navy school in Illinois, there were a bunch of Native people in Chicago mm-hmm. that were going to all kinds of schools, whereas here in Canada, they were stuck on the reserve. They couldn't go. They, you know, they couldn't go anywhere to school. They had to actually get a pass to get off the reserve. Whereas for us, you know, we could go to school, and the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934 put together a $25 million revolving fund in which you have had a tribal council.
Right.
You could borrow money from that and start a business. We had a salmon cannery in the village where I was growing up. The people north of us, there must have been at least six native-owned and operated salmon canneries in southeastern Alaska.
Right.
Others were doing cattle ranching and farm, all sorts of things.
Oh, yeah.
With those things. And so sort of it would work better if we did things ourselves rather than just keep us isolated, whereas here in Canada, you know, in the States they say, well, the cavalry killed a lot of people. Right, they killed us, but here you took away the reason to be alive.
Right.
You take away the children for as many generations that he did. What the hell do you have? Then you complain about them because they're all so messed up. And so anyway, the system was quite different. When, we'll say a Haida woman from a reserve on Haida Gwaii came across to my village in Alaska and married a man from there. She couldn't go home. She couldn't go back because she married a non-status Haida. And so she'd lose her status.
Right.
But if a man went from here over there and married a woman from my village, he brought her back, she became a status Indian by operation of marriage. But if the daughter of that couple also, the son of that marriage married a woman from my village, now it's what they call a double mother. So the children of the second one, when they reach 18, if it was a girl, she had to leave the reserve.
Okay.
Unless she was married to a status person from there, then she could stay. They get their status back. But with the son and his family, they had to leave the reserve. Mm. So they had all kinds of rules for getting rid of people like that, whereas we didn't have that on the U.S. side. We used to have quite a few Haidas come across to the U.S. to work on a fishing boat, working logging camps. And so now many of them are still draw Social Security from the States.
Right.
Because you had to have, I forget how many years, 12 years or something like that, then you're fully eligible to get Social Security from the States. But you couldn't do the same thing coming to Canada because there's a treaty called the Jay Treaty, which it says that we can cross the border freely, but Canada won't let us.
Right.
They freeze you out. Whereas if you're a Native American, we'll put it that way, of 50% or more of blood quantum, you can go right into the States, get your permanent residence, get a Social Security number, and live there for the rest of your life. But you can't do that coming here. I had to come here as an immigrant and go through the whole land of immigrants thing and the whole citizenship thing. So the two systems are very, very different.
It is.
One of my cousins came up to Vancouver about 2 months ago, a month and a half ago. His wife is an artist, and they were coming to Granville Island to buy some art supplies, but he couldn't cross the border because in 1975 he was charged with obstructing a police officer. Mm. And that's what, 30 years ago?
Right.
But still he couldn't come across the border because of that. Now another relative that couldn't come across the border because he got a speeding ticket in 1968. Mm. And so coming to Canada is not, you know, for Native people, it's almost a penalty.
Mm.
Later, when the tribes were moved out of from under the War Department, that's when they started building all these industrial schools. Mm. My father, like I said, went to Sherman Institute in California, and that's where he met my mother. She was Cherokee from Oklahoma, and Dad was Haida from Alaska. So the two worlds are quite different, and I'm not saying one is better than the other. They're different.
Right.
But we didn't have this stuff that went on here, the torturing and killing of children, and not taking, in the States too, people were tattooed with numbers. This was before my generation, though.
Right.
That's what they did. That's where I guess Hitler got the idea to tattoo Jews is to put numbers on them, and then Canada was doing the same thing. But when I went, by the time I got to school in 1955, none of that was going on that I know of.
No.
I spent 1 year in public school. My mother didn't want me to have to get sent away to one of those schools, so she sent me to my Cherokee grandparents in Southern California, where my grandfather worked in apple orchards. My grandmother was a cook at a one-room schoolhouse.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to grade 9 in a public school. And then, but we still had the same problems of not being able to see our parents for long periods of time. So we grew up without parenting skills. We grew up without courtship skills.
Right.
There was a whole lot of things that are really missing from our lives. See, I was really fortunate. You know, well, I'll say in the States we were very fortunate because we had those early years up to, say, grade 8 of being around the old people and learning those early things. Whereas here they took you in elementary school, so those early bonding things and early language and cultural teachings, you didn't get them because you were sent away and it was beaten out of you.
Mm. I have a feeling it's pretty much almost the same in America where African slavery was happening from them, taken away from Africa and shipping them over to America where they had a lot of slaveries.
Yeah, see, that was done by the British. Mm-hmm. They were the ones who were bringing all those slaves over. And then that song that when President Obama started singing, what was it? Anyway, the song he sang was "I Once Was Blind, But Now I See." Amazing Grace.
Amazing Grace, yeah.
That was written by a man who used to be a sea captain on a slave ship.
Right.
And so when you take a look at it, I was in Virginia, North and South Carolina, beginning in 1964.
Right.
I was sent to Virginia to go board ship, the U.S. Navy,
right,
in Norfolk, Virginia. So I saw a lot of those things.
Yeah.
And I was so happy when that rebel flag was pulled down because, to me, it represented all the horrible things that have become a part of life there.
Right.
And people don't realize how much racism we have in this country. I would pass for one of my Scots ancestors. And so I worked in the film business for about 17, 18 years.
Right.
And I used to see these things and hear them. Because I was invisible, they didn't know I was Native. But the moment that many of them discover I was First Nations, they would change how they would behave toward me. They would talk down to me. They'd come over and touch me. People, they see this thing hanging around, piece of them jewelry hanging. They come over and grab it to look at it. And so the whole thing changed. And I worked on the X-Files for 3 years, and I never had a greater experience than that. But we used to shoot at Woodland Hospital and also at Riverview. And I thought to myself, one of the things I saw at Woodland Hospital that still bothers me is there's a beautiful grass area out there. And on one side of the building, they had a patio with stones, you know, patio. And one of the guys says, "Hey, Woody, come on, I want to show you something." So we went over to that patio, and he pulled out one of those small stones. They're about not quite a meter long and about half a meter wide, and turned it over, and it was a gravestone.
Mm-hmm.
They took all the gravestones down for the people that are buried there and used those gravestones to build a patio for a barbecue area.
Mm.
And then they just dumped people out on the streets.
Mm. It's a fantastic story. I wish we could continue on. Gaelic Asa, Woody?
Well, in Ida, it's Ho'a.
Oha.
Ho'a.
Okay.
Ho'a, yeah.
Ho'a.
Okay. Well, anyway, I'm going to get me a T-shirt that says, "Help, I'm talking and can't stop." So anyway, I'll see you next week. And thanks for listening.
Yeah. Take care, everybody.
Wake up to Safer.